Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. This will be my last regular show on Hear Me Out. Robin Washington will be taking over as the new host, and he's with me now, taking the reins.
I mean, I take taking the reins quite seriously here.
Okay? I didn't realize that you had a plan in mind.
Yeah, he has a lot of plans. I figured that out already.
Okay.
Yep, and we'll continue with your introduction, Danny.
Okay, all right.
You did get the horse's name, right?
So start over then?
No, I like this as it is.
All right.
Hello, everyone out there. This is called Radio. I'm Robin Washington, the person who's taking those reins, as we just heard. And and Danny is trying very hard to introduce the other person in the studio, so I'm going to be quiet and make sure. Yeah, come on, you guys. Come on. Okay. All right.
We'll get this back on track.
All right. Your turn.
Okay. Well, with us is the regional manager of the Superior Bureau, Paul Damberg.
Of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh,
don't you
that.
Like an editor sitting right here staring
at you,
correcting everything?
I always appreciate someone correcting me.
I'm not really sure why I'm here, because you two are doing just fine without me. But
well, this
I'm
is
here
what you want us to do, huh?
I know that. It is. I have to say that it's been amazing since I've gotten here to see what Danny does with the Hear Me Out show. It's been spectacular, but she has some new assignments and new priorities within WPR News, and we're really proud and excited to have Robin Washington taking over the reins of the
show. I got
rid
of that clip. Okay. You can't have it
all right
anymore.
Well, we'll be the new regular host of Hear Me Out. And as we said, that doesn't mean that Danny won't occasionally be filling in on the show, but it's going to be wonderful to have Robin on board.
And Danny, you're not going anywhere. You're going to be working out at the Superior Bureau here, correct?
Yes, I will still be covering northern Wisconsin issues and also everything. Well, I shouldn't say everything. all topics related to the environment.
That would be everything.
Wisconsin.
I mean, everybody lives in the environment.
Yeah.
Right?
So.
Although, you know, obviously there are some issues where other reporters may be closer to those at hand, like Foxconn and the Milwaukee Reporter.
Sure.
Much closer. But, you know, for the most part, we'll be tracking environmental issues as it relates to Lake Superior, the Northwoods, and beyond.
And that is geographically, I would say, most of the environment, or all the environment that matters, right?
Well, exactly. And again, Danny has been doing such a good job that she kind of got a promotion, but we're excited that she'll still be officed here and working, and she and Robin will collaborate from occasionally here and there on this and then. So that'll be great. But Robin's going to be the main person driving the Hear Me Out bus as we go forward.
I don't have a bus clip.
I know you don't.
I do cover transportation.
I know you do. That's
life.
Why I did that. So there was a plan.
The wheels go round and round.
That's right.
Oh, okay. Right. So before we go on to what we might do, why don't we take a look at some of the things we have done? And I mean, Danny, you didn't just walk into here yesterday. You've had, I would say, a very esteemed career. And what are some of your highlights? What's again, you're not going anywhere. You're going to be
right.
with us. But still, I think listeners should be reminded some of the great stuff you've given us.
Okay. I guess among that would be some of the coverage we've done here in northern Wisconsin related to rural issues, one of those being the challenges with providing emergency services, especially mm-hmm. with local volunteer departments in northern Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a piece on that?
I do.
MMC, MedTubes en route, Redcliff Intercept, patient complaining of chest pain.
Two paramedics head out from the Ashland Fire Department to help Redcliff's volunteer EMS service with a patient.
We'll step out, grab our gear, and we'll climb into their ambulance to receive a report from the EMTs and basically pick up from there.
That's Rain Ettinger. For the past 5 years, he's been paid to fight fires and help save lives in the Ashland area. That's not the case for Redcliff's EMTs. Bayfield Mayor Larry McDonald says he was in a similar spot several years ago when he had a major heart attack.
Combination of Bayfield volunteer EMS and the Ashland paramedics doing their intercept is a big portion of what kept me alive.
McDonald believes he wouldn't have been so lucky if the local volunteers hadn't been there. Ashland Fire Chief Wayne Chenier says volunteers are vital to rural emergency services because his department can't meet every call for help.
We cover, you know, 400 some square miles for EMS and about a couple hundred for fire. And it is a challenge.
Ashland Fire's first priority is to the city and five nearby towns that pay for service. But paying towns like Eileen explored using the less costly volunteer services. Former chairman Terry Torco says close to half the town's levy goes to pay for emergency services each year, leaving less for road repairs and other services.
It became abundantly clear that our five towns have a problem, but there's a larger problem out there regionally in that the volunteer fire ambulance services are starting to decrease in numbers of volunteers.
Rural volunteer firefighter and first responder Adam Olson says one reason is that people are working long hours or two jobs. He says others shy away from the physical and emotional toll.
It's tough. It may not be easy going to a car accident at 11:30 on a Friday night in a rainstorm, but if we don't go, who will?
Lawmakers introduced a bill this month that would change a state requirement to have two licensed EMTs or similarly trained staff on an ambulance call. Ashland State Senator Janet Bewley says it allows a first responder like Olson to lend a hand.
The EMT is a level up, and it takes more time, more training. There are fewer of them. It just makes it harder to staff that call. This way, we're going to be able to make the best use of the time and energy that our volunteers are willing to commit.
In Washera County, EMS Director Brian Donaldson says the county and Wautoma subsidize a regional ambulance service that staffs ambulances at stations spread around the county. He says that cuts back on duplication of services and cost.
Rural EMS has really struggled because of the limited reimbursement on fees for service.
If we get paid, which is a big if.
That's Rob Poles, paramedic coordinator for Great Divide Ambulance Service in Bayfield County. He says they barely break even when patients are covered by Badger Care and some don't have insurance. To bring in more money, Great Divide provides patient transports for hospitals.
If we took that income away, I'm not really certain that our communities could afford to pay professional people and mixed people like we do now.
But Poles says they may have to find another way. He says more EMS providers are competing for patient transfers to keep their services going. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
So as silly as I tend to be, that's a pretty serious piece.
Yeah, it is. It's a very serious issue for people living in that area in northern Wisconsin, really all of northern Wisconsin.
Exactly.
I mean, it's become more of an issue in recent years as they're seeing people age out of volunteer fire departments volunteer ambulance services. So, and, you know, they're pushing really hard at the state level to try and address some of those things. But there are a lot of requirements, and those requirements exist for a good reason, to make sure that people are trained to do exactly what they have to do to take care of people or to take care of themselves and others in those situations. So,
when was that report?
That one was, 4 years ago now, but it's still an issue that's ongoing.
That's what I was going to ask, yeah. Mm-hmm. Is it any better?
I would argue that the people I talk to say that it's not getting any better. I mean, I just talked to somebody last fall, or a couple of folks last fall, about changes in a state code related to firefighting that they say makes it harder for them to recruit and retain volunteer firefighters. And that was related to some volunteer services here in Douglas County, but also in Bayfield County. And I think the challenges are just that, how are you supposed to get people when the way we live and work is completely different than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. The key word is volunteer.
I mean,
you're asking, and this is not normal volunteer work. This
right.
isn't just like, I volunteer to serve people at the Juneteenth celebration, and that's a lot of work and everything, but it's nothing like going out in the middle of somewhere and putting out a fire.
And very difficult, too, if someone has a day job, to be called away at a moment's notice to take care of your neighbors. That's really...
Right. I mean, my volunteer thing, I know exactly when they're going to be. You don't know when there's going to be a fire in the middle of the national forest.
Exactly right.
And, you know, I'm friends with a couple of volunteer firefighters, and it's a real problem because calls come in at any time and it's drop everything and run. But nevertheless, what matters to me is this is the kind kind of story that Danny covers, has covered, and she does a lot of work. That was not just sitting down with somebody at a table. You were out on the field. You were talking to people in many different locations, and it puts together a news about what's happening right here in our community that's pretty darn hard to find anywhere else. And she has been doing that for years and will continue to do that. And you, as the listener, are the beneficiary of all that effort. And we're really proud of all the great things she has done.
Well, is this a pledge drive?
Yeah, why not?
It's not a pledge drive, but...
But you know, may always send your checks and, and credit card numbers and all. Paul will give you a number at some point or call
him up personally. But at the same time, I do want to draw attention to the fact that you're the beneficiary, as you listen to this, of a lot of hard work from a lot of different people so that you can be informed. And that's our role, and we're going to keep doing that as we go forward.
Right. So you will be listening when we do have a pleasure drive.
That's
so.
A different time, different thing.
Well, along the lines of Danny going out of the office to report something, you can't very well find dog sleds in the... Do we? Maybe we do. I don't know. But anyway...
Don't go in that cabinet.
Yeah. Here's one.
Danielle Kading brings us this audio postcard.
When we moved up here, we were introduced to the racing community through the first Apostle Island Sled Dog Race. And we also had met John and Mary Thiel, who run Wolfsong Mushing. They do it as a business. And they had taken, it was back when they had four dogs. They have 50 now. But when they had four dogs, they took us out, and we just thought that was super fun. And Charlie and I had done some big wilderness trips, and Charlie had this idea that if we had dogs, we could go out and do winter wilderness trips. And so for my birthday one year, he built me a dog box and said we were going to go fill it. I always thought dog sledding would end when my kids weren't interested anymore. And so Caroline had raced four races, and she had been so involved with the dogs. But she was 13, and she's got sports. She's in cross-country ski team. And she basically said, I'm done. Charlie and I agreed we were going to start selling, and he even started selling gear on Craigslist. And he came to me to talk to me about what we should price it at, and I started to cry. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to be done. A month or two later, Blair, who has a racing kennel, called me and said, I have this awesome dog named Popeye who just has a heart murmur, and so he can't do longer races. Are you interested? And I don't know, just that name Popeye, I was sucked in. Every musher has a story about how it started with one dog. Kind of my rebirth in dog sledding started with one dog, and it's Popeye, and he's the loudest one in the kennel.
Well, that was fun.
Yeah. You know, like backstory to going out and collecting sound for that, Julie actually had me try out being on the sled.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I fell over like seven times as we were just getting out on the trail. So I learned that I would make a pretty horrible dog sled. But
as somebody who has dog sledded in the past and run team briefly through a Boy Scout program, you know, it really is intense. But it's also, it's so hard to comprehend the feeling you get when you're on a run, you're running down the side of a lake or a flat space on the ground, and as a guy who grew up snowmobiling, it's silent. And you hear... The dogs are usually pretty quiet. They may be nipping or breathing, but it's really quiet, and the serenity that comes from doing that is pretty powerful. And that piece there helps convey to you what it's like to be on the trail. And Danny did such a great job putting it together.
You know what's interesting about the dog sledding piece is that I was also there to do interviews for a story about a shortage of attorneys in northern Wisconsin.
In dog sleds?
It was separate.
Oh, okay.
Two separate things.
But I don't think we have many attorneys in dog. Well, I take that back.
You might be surprised.
Gunnar Johnson, are you listening? Gunnar Johnson is the city attorney for the city of Duluth. And where did he race recently? Anybody have a guess? Going once?
The Apostle Islands.
It starts with a vowel. Big dog sled race. Ding, 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 ding. So, yes, we do not have, for the record, a shortage of attorneys and dog sled. Gunnar, you need to give us a call.
Okay.
Continue what you were saying, Dan.
Yes.
Well, if you can.
So this story relates to a shortage of attorneys to take on public defender cases. So when there's a conflict in the public defender's office, they need people to represent clients. And Ashland Bayfield Counties has around 25 practicing attorneys, I want to say. And so they've been seeing some real issues in the last year and a half, 2 years, with trying to find attorneys to take cases to defend indigent clients.
Okay, let's take a listen.
Wisconsin has the lowest compensation rate in the country for private attorneys assigned to represent poor people. As Danielle Kading reports, a group of attorneys are hoping the Wisconsin Supreme Court will say the rate is unreasonable in an effort to fix what some are calling a constitutional crisis.
On a Sunday afternoon, attorney Travis Slattery is making the rounds at the Taylor County Jail in Medford.
Yeah, I just called ahead. I'm here to see a couple clients that are here.
It's not his only stop on this trip. The Stevens Point lawyer is driving halfway across the state to meet with several other clients at the Ashland County Jail in far northern Wisconsin. For the last year, Slattery has spent a lot of time on the road. That's why he's driving his wife's red Toyota Prius.
Does 400 miles for less than $20.
While on the road, Slattery takes calls from prosecutors or clients to talk about options for plea deals or serving sentences. He's had as many as 70 open cases in the last year through the state public defender's office, but now he has roughly half that.
And my flat fees that I do for private criminal defense are calculated so that I'm making somewhere around $200 an hour on the average case. So, I mean, I make a lot more money on those cases. When I get those, I prioritize those and take less public defender stuff.
That's a problem for the state public defender's office, which assigns 40% of its caseload to private attorneys like Slattery. He can afford it because he rents office space from another attorney, doesn't have any staff, and stays with family when he takes cases in Ashland. But he's a special case, which is a problem for northern Wisconsin, according to Ashland public defender Mark Perrine.
We just don't have enough attorneys just in our area to cover the cases we need. And I attribute that to a couple of things. One is the rate of pay is too low. It doesn't cover the overhead for most attorneys who have an office. And we just can't get attorneys locally to take our cases.
Perrine says they've sought attorneys from as far away as Madison. Ashland County District Attorney Kelly McKnight says he's seen people wait 2 months or even longer.
They're sitting there on cash bail that they can't post, and they sit in jail, and their case goes nowhere, and they don't have an attorney.
The lack of lawyers willing to take cases can also take an emotional toll on victims and hit county coffers, according to Bayfield County Judge John Anderson.
I've had to intervene and appoint people an attorney at county expense because there just simply isn't the availability of a public defender, and that's something that I've never had to do until the last year or so.
Executive Director David Carroll with the Boston-based Sixth Amendment Center says Wisconsin's rate may mean poor clients aren't getting the effective representation they're guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution.
If you have a financial conflict that you're going to lose more money the more you work on a case, it's going to have a tendency to try to get the lawyer to get the person to plead quicker.
In fact, a 2015 survey of state criminal defense attorneys found they do spend less time with these clients, and about half are taking fewer cases than years past. Attorney John Birdsall with the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers says that's why they're asking the Wisconsin Supreme Court to rule the rate unreasonable, because if they don't,
circuit courts in the state will come to a grinding halt, and people will be sitting in jail for extended periods of time they already are, and there will be a very, very real constitutional crisis.
Travis Slattery says he's taking fewer cases in northern Wisconsin as time goes on.
Because I'm actually getting enough private clients that I make way more money doing other stuff than I do this.
But for now, it won't be long before he's back on the road to meet with the next client hours away. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
So what's an update on that? That was a year ago, actually.
Yeah, it's an ongoing issue, and Governor Evers has proposed in his next two-year state budget to raise the compensation rate for private attorneys to $70 an hour. and lawmakers have actually said that this is a priority for them because there's some uncertainty as to whether everything in Governor Evers' budget, a Democrat, would be approved by Republican lawmakers.
Or anything in his budget. We need more paperclips. Nope.
But
you can't have them.
Republican lawmakers have actually, I guess maybe as a show of support for this issue, introduced a standalone bill in the legislature to increase the rate of pay for private attorneys taking public defender cases. And they've also wrapped some other things into that related to the criminal justice system and providing funding for things like more prosecutors.
Okay. Wonderful. Again, the wide range of topics, but Danny's reporting, talking to people right here and putting in news stories that let you know what your friends, your neighbors are dealing with right here in northern Wisconsin.
And right here on Hear Me Out, there's absolutely no reason we're not going to continue using your reports.
Darn straight.
That you're doing statewide.
Okay, we're going to take a break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. With me is the new host of Hear Me Out, Robin Washington, and our Superior Regional Manager, or our, I should say our Northern Regional Manager.
The boss man.
The boss man.
The dude.
Paul
the guy
Dambert.
Who signs the checks.
Mm-hmm.
You know what your job is now,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Well, Robin, you've reported for WGBH in Boston, nationally for NPR, and here for Wisconsin Public Radio.
I did.
You spent a lot of time on driverless cars, as we've seen that evolve with Tesla and other companies.
Actually, much of 2016, I went to conferences across the country on driverless cars, on other parts of automation, went to a bunch of auto shows. When I went to the first one, very few cars had what I called the big three of what we would say are driverless or autonomy, which is adaptive cruise control, lane assist, and automatic braking. And it's funny, you're nodding your head now because you know what those are. But I remember when I first told you this in 2016, it's like, adaptive what? And
well,
now,
I'm,
yeah.
I just sat in a driverless car for the first time because my cousin got a Tesla, so I was impressed.
And you're here to talk about it too, right? So anyway, we ended up with a week-long series on WGBH in Boston, and let's take a listen.
If you were expecting the future to be like this,
meet George Jetson.
It's turning out more like this.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cat. Where can I take you tonight?
Drive! Drive!
Cars that can drive themselves are here, though maybe without a talking Android. Automakers have been working on the technology for decades.
Tower to Firebird 2. All traffic moving in normal pattern.
We're coming in on the beam, Dad.
In 1956, GM introduced the Firebird 2, a concept car that would follow a white line down the center of an express lane from Phoenix to Chicago.
Well done, Firebird 2. You're now under automatic control. Hands-off steering.
Today, with adaptive cruise control, lane assist, and collision avoidance, thousands of cars can pretty much drive themselves. But they never built those express lanes. Without them, how do you get a car to stay on a road without hitting anything?
My name is John Leonard, and I'm a professor at MIT. I've been obsessed with self-driving cars for a long time, and I think deeply about what it would take to get a fully autonomous car, say, on the streets of Boston.
Professor Leonard identifies several challenges to getting a car to work in its surroundings. He calls the first one
robustness of perception. A self-driving car has to classify things in the world. Is that a pedestrian? Is that a cyclist? Is that a car? And it has to do so with a very high probability of detection, with a very low probability of false alarms.
The second challenge is creating highly detailed maps.
Google uses its maps by having it say, oh, I expected that mailbox over there. I expected that tree. I expected that sign. But the map must be accurate.
If it sounds like it would take an army of people to make maps of that detail, that's exactly what's happening. A company called MobileEye has hired 600 people to chart objects gathered from millions of miles of test driving. Riders on the storm. But even with the most detailed maps, the car still has to be able to see, including in bad weather. In Massachusetts, that means snow. One way to guide vehicles through a storm is by traffic lights sending signals to cars. At the University of Arizona, Professor Jonathan Sprinkle is working on the problem for Uber.
Yeah, it might be traffic lights. It might be a little indicator in your car that tells you what lane is the best lane to be in. It might be organizing vehicles into platoons.
The buzzword behind traffic flow is connectivity, enabling vehicles to talk to each other so they can form platoons, and also to talk to traffic signals. MIT's Professor Leonard says the biggest challenge of all
is dealing with people. For example, a police officer waving me through a red light. I mean, interpreting nods, winks, waves from other people is a very hard thing. Robots are really not good at that.
And of course, pedestrians, who are perhaps the most unpredictable element of all. As far as interacting with people inside the car, the problem is the handoff, determining when humans should take control. I learned something about the handoff when I got behind the wheel of a friend's Tesla with autopilot on Route 128 last spring.
So what do you do with your hands?
I do not text.
My ride along, I'm not sure you can call it driving, was 4 days before Tesla announced the first fatal accident involving one of his cars on autopilot where the driver was similarly riding hands-free. I wouldn't think of taking my hands off the wheel today. The Tesla is not a fully autonomous car. But for the experimental vehicles that are, the University of Arizona's Jonathan Sprinkle says the final challenge is getting people to trust the car, like riding with someone who's just gotten a learner's permit.
Anyone who's ever sat in a car with a learner driver knows that there are many times when they see something about to happen and they're really uncomfortable about what's going to happen.
In fully autonomous test vehicles, Sprinkle says those feelings go away once the ride is completed safely. As for trusting other devices from the future, we still have a ways to go.
James, stop this crazy thing!
Robin Washington, WGBH, Boston's local NPR.
I love the throwback to the Jetsons.
Yeah, no kidding.
You gotta have the
takes
Jets.
Me back a bit. So, again, I know how much went into gathering the information to put that together, as well as the production level, and it's going to be great to have that same dogged pursuitedness on board here with WPR in the northern region and helping to cover the stories that are happening all around us.
We actually did a whole central time on driverless cars, and we got to talk about it there, too.
Cool.
Yeah, and since then, there was that incident out, what was it, in California, where the guy had passed out and behind the wheel. He was coming home late, at 3 a.m., and police actually went in front of the vehicle to get it to slow down.
And, of course, the biggest thing was the Uber accident and fatality in Arizona that, as someone who tracks this thing, completely dampened public enthusiasm about it. So the irony is that in 2016 when we did these pieces, it was really gaining momentum. Seemed like they would be here tomorrow. And now it's more of a social reason that they're not. So
So, again, this is what we're really excited about, is that Robin's been covering issues for a really long time.
Oh, thanks.
And in a positive sense, his expertise, his knowledge, his background is going to, you're the one who's going to benefit from that as he turns his energies now to covering the issues happening in our region.
And he's been offering commentaries about topics that are of issue in the Twin Ports.
So. You know, you guys just set up the next piece. I'm sitting here looking at it on the screen, and you had no idea what was coming up. You said closer to home.
Yep.
You said commentary, and here is a commentary about something closer to home, which was actually on National Public Radio.
Commentator Robin Washington says that for many Black Americans, U.S. national parks remain an untapped resource. But if you've been looking for that perfect place to relax and unwind, he says you may want to give these historical gems a visit.
There are a few sounds that can clear your mind like a waterfall. This one is Gooseberry Falls and is only 35 miles out of Duluth, Minnesota, in one of the most accessible natural areas anywhere. Highway 61 goes right over it. On any weekend, except in January, the parking lot is full, but you won't see many African Americans, There aren't a lot of black people living in northeastern Minnesota. But the real issue is African Americans aren't big visitors to natural areas anywhere in the country. A 2002 survey of the White River National Forest in Colorado found whites made up 96.4% of visitors, Latinos 2.5%, no Native Americans, and barely a percent each of blacks and Asians. Any wonder why it's called the White River? So what is it about black people in the great outdoors? Culturally, we should have deep connections to it, and you don't have to go all the way back to Africa. Though no one is nostalgic for slavery, our roots in the American South were rural, and being able to hunt and fish and live off the land was necessary for survival. That changed when great masses of blacks migrated to the cities. But the bigger reason you don't find black families packing a car and heading for the Great Smoky Mountains is that for a long time, we couldn't. Or not at least without running into white or colored signs. Before the Civil Rights Movement, state segregation laws frequently prevailed over federal rules for national parks, especially in the South. If you were a black family looking for a vacation spot, the last thing you wanted was to drive 100 miles into the wilderness to a place where you weren't supposed to be, with a lot of people willing to keep you out. Those days are gone, and African Americans today are overwhelmingly tied to the cities. The word urban is even a synonym for black. But not all blacks. A frequent visitor to Minnesota's Gooseberry Falls and anywhere else he can get to is wildlife photographer Dudley Edmondson, who lives in Duluth. His new book, Black and Brown Faces in America's Wild Places, tells the stories of 19 other black outdoors people, including birders, forest rangers, and even a big game hunter named Hank Williams Jr. No, not Hank Williams Jr., the country singer, but Hank Williams Jr., the black cowboy, who says he enjoys roping and riding and has just bought 32 acres in northern Minnesota to do so. The book also includes mountaineer Elliot Boston III, who says he's the first black person to scale the highest peak in Russia. There hasn't been a second one yet. Like Dudley Edmondson, all of them tell experiences of being the only black faces in the outdoor areas they frequent, and all of them say they hope that will change. Even as most black people do live in a city, protecting the environment is as important for people of color as it is for white people. Don't think just because you have more melanin than someone else that the disappearing ozone layer will be nice to you. The most important reason to get outside is what it can do for your soul as well as your body. For that, you have to listen for the sound of Gooseberry Falls.
Wow. Gooseberry makes a national debut.
It does. And some interesting statistics there that I was unaware of. And, you know, you have been doing great commentaries here, and I listen and I learn every time that you do. That skill set is going to aid you greatly as you endeavor now creating wonderful stories and pieces and parts for Hear Me Out.
And this is something that, again, has you guys both set up this piece talking about local and commentary. And yet this was a national piece. You know, we all live on one planet, as Danny is going to tell us all about in the environment, right? And even though we think we are special in the Twin Ports area and know we have this wonderful lake and we're in this beautiful environment, but, you know, we are connected to the rest of the world. So that piece is sort of foreshadows one vision I have for the program. It could change. It's up to you, listeners. But I have a lot of contacts in the industry, in broadcasting and in journalism, who have a whole bunch of stuff they want to share with us. One, to tease, I think we're going to have a piece on something called climate change anxiety. Apparently, there are people who have difficulty functioning. This is not a joke. Because of climate change worries. And
well, when you hear some of the stories that are coming about how it's going to warm between 3 and 7 degrees in the next 100 years, I mean, that's frightening.
Right.
And how do you
We're going to find out about this because the person who produced this approached me and I said, you know, this would be great to run your piece and then have local panelists talk about it. So
right.
If you want to be a local panelist, contact Paul. We're making Paul the contact guy
sure.
here. And
oh,
say,
sure.
I want to be a local panelist
That's
to
fine.
talk about climate change anxiety.
All right. There is a lot that happens up here. And we all know at times that we feel elsewhere is not caring about what we're doing here, but we're excited that Robin and Danny will continue to do the great works they do and continue to bring you the information about happenings, events, and the news from right here in northern Wisconsin, as well as a little bit on the other side, on the Duluth side, because you're listening to us, you're part of our audience, and we want to inform you on the things that matter to you.
And that would include, I'm just going to say it, my favorite things. So since this is our little showcase, yep, to share our favorite things, I have to say one of the most fun radio pieces I ever worked on was a documentary of John Coltrane's recording of My Favorite Things, partially produced in these studios. And so let's give a little listen.
It's one of the most familiar songs in the history of jazz. And if you don't quite know this version, you're sure to know another.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
October 21st marks 50 years since John Coltrane recorded My Favorite Things, transforming a Broadway tune into one of the most enduring jazz standards. I'm Robin Washington. Saxophonist John Coltrane was one of the most influential jazz musicians of all time. He was born in North Carolina in 1926 to the musical family of an African-American tailor. While a teenager, he moved to Philadelphia to study music and joined the U.S. Navy Band in World War II. After the war was the bebop era of jazz, and he soon met up with Dizzy Gillespie and also played with Thelonious Monk.
I met him, you know, and I just started hanging around with him. I like that music.
In a 1958 interview with jazz writer August Bloom, Coltrane described his personal and professional admiration for Monk, telling how the improvisational artist would write his music down.
I'd go by his house, you know, by his apartment, and get him out of bed maybe or something. And he'd wake up and roll the piano and start playing. He'd look at me, I just start trying to find what he's playing. And I'd get this part, and then next time we go over there, I'd get another part. And if I had a lot of trouble, he'd get his portfolio out. Show him the music, he's got music, he's got all of it written.
During this time, Coltrane spent two stints with the Miles Davis Quintet. The first time, Davis fired him.
About that time, I made a decision, you know, stop drinking more.
The "and stuff" was heroin. He kicked it and instead found an intense spirituality through music that would consume him the rest of his life.
I was able to play better right then, you know.
He returned to Miles' group to record Kind of Blue. The 1959 recording would become the biggest-selling jazz album ever. Now living in New York, Coltrane and his fellow jazz artists dominated the clubs of Greenwich Village and Harlem. But in Midtown on Broadway, a different musical fair was captivating the country.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and water.
The singer is Mary Martin, the original star on Broadway of Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music.
These are a few of my favorite things.
The true life story of the Von Trapp family singers, the musical was wildly successful, so much so that the real Von Trapp family wanted a piece of the action, and that same year recorded an album themselves. Steve Coon was a young jazz pianist in New York who could attest to the popularity of the song, but he said it made little impact on him musically. More important at the time was that John Coltrane was starting his own quartet and chose him on piano. Like Thelonious Monk, Coltrane wrote down his compositions as sheet music.
Yes, I still have over there somewhere, I have a little music notebook that he wrote out, some voicings and changes, Equinox, Mr. Sims, Naima.
Wow, that's a deep dive into an amazing musician, and of course, it's only fitting that we do be airing a piece you did on John Coltrane, as of course every weekday night on KUWS 91.3 FM. You can hear 91 Jazz Street.
Are you making a shameless plug?
Would I do such a thing like that? Oh, come on. Oh, pshaw. Well, I know you've got some other things we want to hear.
Sure, but I think Danny wants to give us a station break right now. Right?
You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. With me is the new host of Hear Me Out, Robin Washington, and also our regional manager, Paul Damberg.
Well, this has been a lot of fun.
It is.
And it will continue to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Except one thing. Well.
Okay. Okay. What now?
First of all, I hit the wrong button here.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, I know. Here. Okay, you guys didn't ask me what I was going to change.
What are you going to change?
Yeah.
About the show. Well, oh, you're going to change the music, aren't you?
So, I mean, you know, it's kind of catchy, our little theme song, right?
Yeah.
What do you think of this? Well, yeah, and you guys could be in the background.
Egads. There's no pretentiousness here at all.
This is Hear Me Out. Or else.
Yeah. One of those few times.
Is that what you, had in mind, Paul?
Not exactly. Not quite exactly.
Is that what they had at the beginning of 2001, A Space Odyssey?
Ding, ding, ding. You're right, Danny. It was definitely 2001.
Yay!
Which was done way earlier than 2001.
Yeah, it was. So, all right. I will step into my role as regional manager and say that will not be the new theme
music. Okay.
I would just like to thank Brent Knotbaum and his film and culture class. That's where I picked that up from. So.
See? Okay. There you go. And if you had gone to Cornell College.
John Coltrane would be in your knowledge book.
Ooh, I love the rhyme.
There you go.
Right. Well, Danny, why don't you tell us what's going on this week?
Well, now we're going to take a look back on some of the news of the week. Wisconsin's congressional delegation is weighing in on the release of a redacted report on special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference during the 2016 election. Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson thinks redacting grand jury testimony and classified information is probably appropriate. Johnson made the remarks on WPR's The Morning Show Thursday prior to the report's release. But Johnson said that doesn't mean it won't be frustrating to sift through and interpret Mueller's findings.
we'll see whether the American people get the full information here. I kind of doubt they will. It's one of the reasons I never really supported a special counsel being appointed right up front.
Johnson said congressional investigations should have finished first and then referred any activity that could bring criminal charges. Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin tweeted she will thoroughly review the report, adding, quote, "We need the full Mueller report, the full truth." But other Republicans like Congressman Sean Duffy say the report confirms there was no collusion between Russians and President Trump's campaign. Democrats like Congresswoman Gwen Moore say the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committee should be able to see a full unredacted copy.
Just a few excerpts that I was able to read, it said that there was substantial evidence that the president attempted to prevent the investigation into his campaign and into his own conduct.
Moore adds she'd like to hear from Mueller himself. New York Democrat and House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler says he will issue a subpoena for the full report and has asked Mueller to testify before the panel by May 23rd. Governor Tony Evers said Wednesday that Wisconsin's contract with tech giant Foxconn may need to be renegotiated. Laurel White has more.
The governor said it's unrealistic to believe that Foxconn will employ 13,000 people in the state. That's because of recent reports that the company is changing the size of its planned facility in southeastern Wisconsin. Speaking to reporters at the Capitol, Evers said Foxconn's change of plans means its contract with the state should be revisited.
Clearly, the deal that was struck is no longer in play. And so we will be working with individuals at Foxconn, and of course, with WEDC to figure out how a new set of parameters should be negotiated.
Republican Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says the move will undermine the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Foxconn has maintained that it will employ 13,000 people. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And the governor and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes visited Superior this week as part of budget listening sessions they're holding across the state. People had breakout sessions at UW-Superior Monday night on a variety of topics. Barnes says health care was a recurring theme.
Someone rose and spoke about either it was a teacher or an administrator in the school district that said there is a support staff who comes to work not for a paycheck, but just for the health care.
Barnes and Evers have been pushing for the state to expand Medicaid, and Wisconsin recently withdrew from a multi-state lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin Republican leaders have said federal funding to expand Medicaid may fall through. They've said it's a non-starter in the legislature. And Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes also toured UW-Superior's Lake Superior Research Institute on Tuesday. For more than a decade, LSRI has been working to test ballast water treatment systems. Ships have been known to transport invasive species to the Great Lakes through discharging ballast water. The Institute's director, Matt Tenick, believes installing treatment systems aboard ships is the best way to prevent further spread of invasive organisms in the Great Lakes.
Early on in the process, we had looked at having like a land-based treatment system like you would with sewage treatment plants. It's not feasible because ships have to a ballast to go through that operation while they're traveling across the ocean.
Barnes says the state should support research at institutions like LSRI.
You look at the innovation that's coming out of here, out of the laboratory that we just visited, especially in terms of, you know, taking the ballast water in from ships, treating it, putting it back out there. I mean, if you look at, you know, water issues, not just here in Wisconsin, across the globe, this is another opportunity where Wisconsin can be a leader.
Governor Evers' budget proposal includes a $150 million funding increase to the University of Wisconsin system. Canadian firm Husky Energy held a town hall meeting in Superior on Tuesday night about the company's $400 million plans to rebuild its oil refinery after an explosion and fires last spring. Community members expressed mixed feelings about how the company is moving forward. Husky announced earlier this month that it plans to continue using hydrogen fluoride. The highly toxic chemical caused an evacuation of city residents last April. Superior resident Andre Latender wants the company to stop using it.
We're proud of the fact that Husky is here doing things. Please do better. We want to be very proud of what you do. We want you guys to be setting an example for refineries across the country.
But Northern Wisconsin Building and Construction Trades President Kyle Bukovich says the rebuild will bring economic opportunity to Superior.
When an incident happens, there's always new ideas on how we can make stuff safer. And I think with all the trades being in contact with Husky, I think there's going to be a good plan going forward.
Husky's refinery manager says they hope to be able to begin rebuilding the refinery this fall. Ashland officials and representatives of the Wisconsin DNR took part in a forum this week about the city's woes with its aging sewer system. The city has around 60 miles of sewer lines. Of that, a majority of the city's sewer pipes are more than 60 to 100 years old. The cost to fix the city's aging system is currently estimated to be around $15 million. That's more than Ashland's annual operating budget. John Butler is the city's public works director.
To fix this problem effectively, we're going to have to be looking at expanding the storm sewer system itself. It's not just strictly a sanitary sewer problem.
Ashland is not the only community dealing with aging systems. A 2016 U.S. EPA survey found $271 billion is needed to maintain and improve the nation's wastewater infrastructure. Republican lawmakers have introduced a bill to add another circuit court branch in a dozen counties across the state. The proposal is an effort to address growing judicial workloads. DePeer Republican Senator Andre Jacques introduced the bill. He says the proposal would add another judge in counties seeing the heaviest workloads and case backlogs.
Justice delayed is sometimes justice denied. It helps victims find closure, helps get defenders into treatment, helps judges to be able to participate in treatment courts.
A state report showed Sawyer County in northern Wisconsin has the highest judicial workload. Judge John Yackel is the only judge who presided over around 400 felony cases there last year.
It is putting a great amount of stress on the jail by not getting these cases processed as quickly.
If passed, the bill would add another judge and court reporter in a dozen counties, including Marathon, Eau Claire, and Calumet counties.
Well, this has been a lot of fun.
It is.
And it will continue to be a lot of fun.
Yes.
Danny, we thank you for all your great work on the show, past, present, and future.
And I was going to say, and especially for all the great things yet to be done by you.
I was just going to thank Robin for all the things that he's going to do with the show.
Right.
And we're going to thank you, the listener, because this is getting way too warm and fuzzy in here.
Right.
So you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio, and we'll leave you with the music of John Coltrane.